Welcome, everyone, to our third session with Reverend Richard Norris III. He is with us today from Philadelphia. He's on Zoom, and he's actually preaching at his church, his AME church. He's been telling us about its history and traditions, and that will continue today. It's been a wonderful series. If you've missed any, just catch it online on the recording. And I'll just quickly turn it over to Richard.
Thanks, Sarah. Good morning, everyone. Happy to be with you all today virtually from Sarah mentioned in the city of Philadelphia. And as it has already been mentioned, I am scheduled to preach today at my home church here in Philadelphia. And we start service at 10:30. So we're gonna move through some of the information today, not at light speed, obviously, but with some speed. So bear with me, and if you know we get to the end of our time today, and there are still lingering questions, you know, you can send them to Sarah or send them to me directly, and I'll respond, you know, in a personal way, or I can pick it up when we come back next week for the last part of the series. But first, let's pray. Kind and loving God, we thank you now for this time together, this time of sharing. We ask that you bless it so that it might be enriching for all those who participate today. In your name we pray. Amen. Okay, so last week, we talked about some of the prominent people and places in the AME Church's history. I gave you a very, very high-level overview of some of their lives and some of their stories, of the people and institutions that, you know, are prominent in our church's history. This week, I want to dive into our denomination's governance structure, our polity, if you will. I mentioned last week that it really took me a while to understand how you all do things as a church in the Presbyterian Church USA, because Methodist polity is just different. There are a few things that I want to highlight here to give you an insight as to how we operate and we function as the AME Church, because it's a little bit different than you know, our United Methodist siblings. So first I want to start off with showing you this map of the AME Church's territory. So ever since the denomination was formally established in 1816, the AME Church spread like wildfire throughout the United States. You might not be able to make out all the specific countries here, and that's okay. When the slides are uploaded, you can look at it, you know, more deeply. But I just want to underscore here that today, the AME Church can be found in 39 countries across 5 continents, and the spread throughout the United States was pretty rapid, especially after the Civil War. As Southern states, you know, came back into the Union, and you know, American territory, you know, continued to expand, but a lot of the international expansion took place toward the end of the 19th century and going into the 20th century. So, you know, even as early as 1840, we have evidence of Mars Brown allowing the formation, or you know, giving credence to the formation of the Canadian Annual Conference, in 1840. Bishop Henry McNeil Turner was instrumental in moving the church into West Africa, as you see here. He started with Ghana and he started with Liberia and Sierra Leone, and that was in 1891. And not too long after he did that, Charlotte McClay introduced the AME Church to South Africa, or rather introduced South Africa to the AME Church and adjacent nations at the turn of the 20th century. And so, you know, again, 39 countries across 5 continents, we're still gaining, we're still trying to gain a more solid foothold in our South American and Caribbean countries like Brazil and Cuba. But you know, these are labored processes that take quite a while. The newest addition to our family, the fifth continent, if you will, that we were able to reach into was the subcontinent of India. India became a part of the AME Church formally in 2008 at our general conference in St. Louis, Missouri. And you'll hear a little bit more about that as we go on. But I just wanted to give you a sense of, you know, where we are today as a denomination. Oh, and let me say, I can't see you all, so if feel free to interrupt me if you have questions. Okay, so like I said, we're a bit different than our United Methodist siblings in the sense that, well, there are some similarities and there are some differences. So, like our United Methodist siblings, all of our church is divided into regions. They're called like annual conference, and they span, you know, certain geographic areas, much like, you know, you have with the Presbytery. Like, you know, you have the Pittsburgh Presbytery, and I know here in Philadelphia is the Philadelphia Presbytery. The annual conference functions essentially like that. Unlike our United Methodist siblings, our annual conferences are merged into and organized rather into Episcopal districts. Much like I know the PCUSA has synods that are groupings of presbyteries, and the districts are essentially that, right? And our bishops, and so like in the United Methodist Church, bishops are assigned to annual conferences, but in our church, bishops are assigned to Episcopal districts. So one bishop oversees a grouping of annual conferences called a district. So my hometown, Philadelphia, and much of eastern Pennsylvania is grouped into the Philadelphia Annual Conference, which is a part of the first district, which pretty much includes the entire Northeast, ex you know, except for Western Pennsylvania and the island of Bermuda. Where you all are in Pittsburgh, that is the third Episcopal district, which is Western PA and Scranton, Ohio and West Virginia. Some of these boundaries are outdated. You know, it's been a long discussion in our church about how things are apportioned and things like that. So these boundaries really are the result of historical precedent, not necessarily feasibility right now. Because I always contend that Scranton probably could be a part of the New York Conference or the Philadelphia Conference, because the seat of the Pittsburgh West Virginia Conference is in Pittsburgh, which is 5 hours away from Scranton. But in any event, that's how the boundaries were drawn. So, again, just to give you a peek into how things look now, and I will say that this graphic actually is a bit outdated for the third district. A couple of years ago, it was decided that the Pittsburgh Conference and the West Virginia Conference would merge and become one conference. Same thing with the Ohio and the South Ohio conferences. So instead of the five conferences you see here, there are it's the same geographical area, but instead of five conferences, there are only three conferences in third district. And so one bishop oversees, with the help of you know, pastors and presiding elders, oversees the work of this of these districts. So when we look at our organizational chart, at a very high level, this is how these bodies are what give governance to the AME Church. At the very top, you have, and I'll tell you more about the General Conference and the Annual Conference in a little bit, because those are really the two pillars that hold up the AME Church. But in addition to their What makes those two bodies work? You have we have our Council of Bishops, which essentially functions as the executive branch of the AME Church. They are elected every 4 years at our general conference, and they really are the most I won't say the most powerful body, but they hold a lot of power in our churches. The bishops that assign preachers to churches, it's the bishop that ordains people into ministry. It's the bishop that oversees the work of the Episcopal districts and the annual conferences from day to day. We also have our board of incorporators, which serves as, they serve primarily as like the trustees of the AME Church, and they supervise all of the property that we own and maintain. That's really their primary function. Then we have the general board, which is really the administrative body of the church. So the general conference only meets every 4 years, and its work is mainly legislative in nature. And legislating the church is not a day-to-day activity, but administering the church is. In the interim of the general conference, the general board meets to carry out the church's business. And finally, we have the judicial council, which is an appellate court that serves as the essentially like the Supreme Court of the AME Church. So, like I said before, the two pillars that hold up the AME Church are the annual conference and the general conference. So this I'll start with the annual conference, and this first bullet point I have here is like the glossary definition of what the annual conference is that you can find in our excuse me, in our discipline. A geographical grouping of congregations in a specified geographical area to form the legal entity of Methodist polity. This is where mission, resource personnel, both clergy and lay, and property are administered, and where a bishop serves as president. And I just really want to stress here that the annual conferences are the legal bodies that make up the AME Church. For myself as a minister in the AME Church, my ministerial orders were given to me on behalf of the annual conference. They are the property of the annual conference, and if I were ever to leave the AME Church, I would have to surrender my ministerial orders back to the annual conference because it's the property of the annual conference. Our local church bodies and structures, those properties are actually deeded to the annual conference. We hold them in trust for the annual conference. And so if a church wants to sell any property that it owns, it can't do that without the consent of the Board of Trustees of the annual conference. The conference is the legal entity through which the church is administered. And the annual conference meets yearly at the call of the bishop. It's comprised of all clergy, component leaders, and at least one delegate, well, not at least, just one delegate, excuse me, from each congregation. And some Episcopal districts, they hold their annual conferences in the spring. Like my district, we're the first district is currently in, we're in our annual conference season right now. We just closed the New England Annual Conference this past Friday, and this week the New York Annual Conference will meet in Harlem. But where you all are in the third Episcopal District has a fall schedule. Their annual conferences will meet between September and October. So that's the annual conference. Now, the general conference, as I said before, meets every 4 years, and it is the supreme body of the AME Church. It's where we come together with delegates from all 20 Episcopal districts to elect new leaders and pass new laws to be included in the discipline. That's our governing body document. You all have the Book of Order. We have the discipline. And each annual conference is empowered to elect a certain number of delegates. It's the same number of clergy and lay delegates proportional to that annual conference's size. Like I said, it meets every 4 years, and it rotates locations A couple of years ago, we met in Columbus, Ohio, and in a couple of years, we're going to go to Kansas City, Missouri, to hold the annual conference. All right. So, I know I went through that pretty quickly, but I just really wanted to underscore that these are the two pillars that really hold up the church, and the General Conference is its own. Is its own entity. And so the Council of Bishops produced a documentary film called Echoes from the General Conference, which goes through some of the history of General Conference and some of the pivotal moments. And I pulled some selected scenes from there. If you go back and if you go when these slides are uploaded, I did put the a full documentary link in the presenter notes, so you can watch the full documentary if you like. But I just wanted to pull a few scenes here to highlight what goes on at the General Conference and what it means to us. So enjoy.
Bishop Bright convinced me to get back in the race. So about 6 months before the General Conference, he called me to his bedside and said, "Now I am very sick and I'm going to the General Conference. The doctors told me I might not come back alive." And I told the doctor, "I don't have to come back alive, but I must go." When I was elected, he took me up to the rostrum and embraced me. And he went and sat down and came back and embraced me the second time and asked me to please be a good bishop. I said, I'll do my best to be a good bishop. And he sat down, came back the third time and said the same thing. This time he took his episcopal ring off his finger and put it on mine, took off his badge and put it on me. Said, "Now be a good bishop." He hugged me, squeezed me tight, and went back and sat down and keeled over and died. Had to come, didn't have to go back, but he had to come. It's almost like mysterious, something that happens every 4 years, and people gather like going to the Mecca.
And each General Conference is its own creation, its own creature, its own autonomy. It can do many, many wonderful things.
And we've been doing this since 1816. And for all of my years, it has been a rather intimidating place.
The most part, we go to the General Conference with the excitement of electing new officers and new bishops, general officers, as well as passing new laws.
And when people are passionate about their idea of how things ought to run, or a piece of legislation, or a particular candidate, often we tend to do it with great verbiage.
General Conference usually is like a roller coaster up and down. An action and a counteraction.
And I believe the General Conference is the one place where people felt like they had the right to challenge without the thought of punishment, because it was a free agent. So I think that's the reason that it was unpredictable about the behavior of people there.
That people want to be heard, and some folk who really gravitate toward the microphones and want to be heard and state their points.
I was always impressed with seeing the bishops of the AME Church in the processional, and I used to have to sit so far back that I could never make out who anybody was.
The other thing that was amazing was the election of bishops. It was an all-night affair, and we stayed there throughout the night. I didn't want to miss a minute of it.
I saw the long, weary nights and days.
Food would be brought in, and sometimes the food would be brought in on the floor, where people would have to try to have some nourishment, and then you could look around and see some people asleep.
I was surprised how people stayed with the process despite how long the process took and how tired many of them literally physically appeared. That hanging in there till the end, that stick-to-itiveness, I guess, of AMEs just really surprised me. It was amazing.
We present to you at this time a great leader, Martin Luther King.
I never knew until 1964 that you could actually see electricity in the air. Because when Dr. Martin Luther King came to speak, and the convention center was packed to capacity.
It was almost like electricity, or like a tornado.
I fortunately was asked to be on the delegation that went to pick him up. I actually drove the car myself. And went to get him to bring him to the General Conference. I felt 1,000 feet tall.
That's a good demonstration of the effectiveness of the General Conference. Everybody was talking about General Conference because of Martin Luther King, for social issues.
The AME Church has always been very active in the whole arena of civil rights. The church then also had its stamp of approval for all those who were willing to join into the battle.
I still remember hearing that long-playing LP of Dr. King's address to the General Conference, Sleeping Through a Revolution. Bishop Frederick Calhoun James presented him, and it was a stirring. It is still an inspiring message if you hear it even today.
To the distinguished bishops of this great church, and to all of the general officers and delegates to this General Conference of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, ladies and gentlemen.
I've invented a word. It's called euthanize. Normally, euthanization has to do with killing something or letting something die mercifully. My notion of euthanize, youth-anize, is to see young people back in the church.
The legislation that I can think about that has had a far-reaching impact on the church, one was the inclusion of young people.
A group of young adults began to meet around the country to talk about how we would include young adults in the life of the church. And we held a lot of our meetings in Philadelphia. The late Dorothy Jenkins and Robina Castleberry, the late Reverend Smallwood, who was the director of Christian education, a group of them, they were our advisors.
They were the epitome of Christian education. They really had something going.
I was a part of the group that carved out the legislation that young adults and persons under 30 would have a voice at the General Conference, would be a voting delegate to the General Conference.
It was challenging, exciting, but for me, it took on special meaning. The late Dr. H.C. Coswell, who was an institution in Georgia, the young people were seated in the balcony, the observers, and Dr. Coswell said, Richard Allen took us out of the balcony to bring us on the main floor. And I think we ought to bring the young people down on the floor as members of the General Conference.
'72 in Dallas, Texas. That was a very exciting time for me.
It was hot. It was politically hot. There were deep emotions about a lot of things politically going on at the time. The church spoke to that.
The General Conference had been alerted that President Nixon was going to attend and to address the conference. And as it turned out, at the appointed hour, we discovered that it was not the president at all, but that it was his brother who had been sent as a surrogate to speak in his place. that was not at all well received by the delegation.
It so happened they put him in a committee to go receive him and to usher him in. And just as we approached the platform, it went into pandemonium.
Absolutely incredible to see how quickly a protest could be organized. He popped in the middle of worship, like just after the Decalogue, something early on in the worship experience. And I can remember I was sitting in the gallery of sorts, and I'm watching these leaders of the church gathering at the rear of the auditorium and marching in a procession toward the stage, and then flooding the stage.
I heard all of this noise coming from the back of the auditorium and went straight to the pulpit, took the microphone. Bishop Bright and Bishop Jordan stood up with the Black Power sign and said to the General Church, "Nothing comes before us before we have worship."
When that interruption occurred, Bishop Jordan got up, protested, and walked out. Many of us joined him. When we got outside and the press was pressing, "Why did we treat the president's brother that way?" And I explained that Mr. Dixon's attitudes on race and his general demeanor were not very popular with us, and therefore we did not want his brother. But the main offense was that they interrupted the worship service, which we all felt was very inappropriate.
When President Obama, then Senator Obama, came in our last General Conference, I was so profoundly impressed because it gave the AME Church again that connection of leadership, that we were actively engaged in helping to make this wonderful experience happen.
At that time, he was not president, but we could see him on the front steps.
I want to take this one chance and this one opportunity to see if we could break the black ceiling and see if we could not have an African-American who was very, very capable to become president of the United States. So I spoke for him, made visits for him. I wrote the first national clergy letter for him.
We had a long time in preparation and in waiting for him to arrive and be cleared, and for us to be cleared to go into the room to meet with him.
And now we were all standing there, crowded in this room. And Senator Obama, now President Obama, said, "Would you pray for me?" Bishop Bryant was asked to lead the prayer. And he may have put his hands on the president first. We reached out and everybody closed their eyes, you know, and then we prayed for him.
The Obama candidacy really became the theme of the General Conference.
It always is tough on the schedule because his schedule is up in the air. But I do think that it was good that we had prayer with him.
And then when he went out and made his eloquent speech, he turned directly to me and shook my hand. And I had a feeling then that he would become the 44th president of the United States.
Keep me in your prayers, AME. Keep my family in your prayers, AME. Go out and organize with me, AME. Go out and march with me, AME. If I've got you standing with me, then I won't fear anybody.
Okay, we're running a little short on time here, so I have to end it there. But the last bit in there was about the idea of a global church. Like I told you how, you know, the AME Church is in a multitude of countries across the world. And the growing tension that has existed when it comes to, when we talk about like making sure that all of every AME feels included when we make decisions and things of that nature. But again, like I said, when these slides are uploaded in the presenter notes, you'll be able to see the link to the full documentary with, you know, some of the bishops will talk about their experience and their take on it and learn a little bit more about how we introduced the subcontinent of India to our fold. I'll leave that as a little bit of homework for you. And if there are things about that piece particularly that you want to tease out, we can come back to that next week. But that's about what I had for you today. I apologize that I had to run through a lot of it quickly. But if there are a couple of questions, I can field those now.
Questions? Doug?
Richard, good to see you on something other than a Tuesday morning.
Indeed.
Hey, tell us a little about your church in Philadelphia. Where is it in Philadelphia? How many members? You know, what's it all about? And you're the minister in chief there, correct?
No, sir. So my church here in Philadelphia is Morris Brown AME Church. It's in North Philadelphia. I'm just a minister on staff here at Morris Brown. This is actually the church that I was raised in. Stood the test of time. We've been here for about 45 years. Not quite as big and populated as we have been in years past, but still a solid presence in the community. Not the minister in charge, though.
We miss you back here. You did a great job with us as an intern, and we appreciate that greatly.
I appreciate that. Miss you all, too.
Here we go.
Good morning. I was wondering how many youth are involved in your church right now, and how many, and what are they doing?
So we're slowly but surely, rebuilding the youth. It wasn't too long ago that I was considered one of the youth of this church, and a lot of my contemporaries, we have, gone to school and graduated. I'm one of the few that actually came back to Philadelphia. A lot of the young people that are coming into Morris Brown now are, you know, school-aged children. So we're really getting back to our roots of forming them in ministry, giving them opportunities to serve and worship and things like that.
Barb, I saw that you joined, and I think you had a couple of questions. Feel free to unmute and ask your questions. Anyone else with questions? We'll give time for Barb if she wishes to unmute, but we can take other questions. I think we've got some food for thought here, Richard, and we wish you Godspeed this morning.
I appreciate that. Yeah, so and if there are any lingering questions about what I presented on today, like I said in the beginning, please reach out to Sarah or Ted, or send them to me directly, and I can respond personally, or we can pick that up when we come back for the last part next week. But next week, what we're going to do is it hadn't dawned on me that I had never gone through what worship looks like in an AME church. It's a little bit different from what you are about to experience if you haven't been to worship yet at 11 a.m. But it's what next week I'm going to do is I'm going to take you through a traditional AME order of worship on a Sunday morning. I'll tell you a little bit more about my love for hymns, which, you know, you probably, if you remember, I was not very shy about when I was there at Westminster, but that's what we'll do next time. So Again, I'm sorry that I had to run through everything as quickly as I did today, but thank you for attending and thank you for your attention. We'll see you
Thank
next
you
week.
very much.